This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Today is your lucky day. The champ uploaded a new video and you found it. I'm joking. It's your lucky day because IslamNet is establishing a mega masjid and da'wah center, and you have a unique opportunity to be part of that. So click the link below and donate now.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? And welcome to the most inconsistent podcast in the world, the MH podcast, but actually it's becoming a little bit more consistent. And I'm here joined with someone that probably to you guys does not need an introduction, but I'll give it anyway. He's a historian. He's a person who is one of the premier debaters of the Muslim world. He has debated some of the top guys in the Christian world and in other faith traditions as well, and has come on top. I'm talking about none other than the one and only Adnan Rashid. How are you doing? Okay, mashallah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, man. You know, it's, I think, long overdue. A lot of people have been asking me to do this kind of things with you. And now, because we've got the conflict, let's not call it the conflict, let's call it the oppression of the Palestinian people. We've got the oppression of the Palestinian people. It's piqued people's interest in terms of exactly the history of Palestine, the history of Jewish people, the history of the interaction between Muslim people and Jewish people. Today, we want to focus on some of the interactions between Muslim people and Jewish people, because the narrative, there is one narrative which is quite sinister and insidious, which seems to indicate that the Muslim Project, not Hamas or any of these groups, no, the Muslim Project itself is one that attempts to kill off all of the Jewish people, and that Islam is intolerant of Jews, and that the historical record basically shows that. So how would you, and you've debated this issue as well with prominent individuals and less prominent individuals as well, how would you debate this issue? How would you make a builder case for the contrary point of view?
So a lot of the Zionist propagandists, they come up with this idea that Islam is inherently anti-Jewish. This is what they claim. Therefore, we need a homeland, we need to protect ourselves, we need to take land from the Palestinians and build our own ancient homeland. Or homeland that was ancient, we need to reclaim it, we need to take it back. And they quote biblical verses in this regard to claim that they have possession or they have right over this land. Okay. So we show them that Muslims ruled the land of Palestine in particular and much of the land around it for nearly 1,000 years with an iron fist, with strength, with military presence, with economic dominance, with educational inspiration, and all those things. Muslims did great things. Islamic civilization or the Muslim civilization was one of the greatest things that happened in this region. Okay, the question now is, how did the Muslim civilization treat the Jewish people as an entity, as a community?
Yeah.
And those Zionists who are claiming this today, propagandists, liars, outright liars,
yes,
who claim this, that the Jewish people suffered under the rule of Islam, so we cannot be ruled by the Muslims. Okay? If the Palestinians want their land back, and they want all of it back, the Israelis come back and say, you cannot have all of it back because you will kill all of us. Okay.
For example,
so when people, Palestinians, when they want this land back, the Israelis come back and say, oh, that means a genocide of the Jewish people. This is the game a lot of these Zionist propagandists play deliberately, quite deliberately.
That's right.
They claim that if the Palestinians are to come back to their lands and take their lands back, that means automatically a genocide of the Jewish people, because Jewish people are not safe under Palestinians or the Muslim people in general. We want to undo that notion today. We want to present evidence to the contrary and show how the civilization of Islam or the Muslim civilization saved the Jewish people for over 1,000 years. What do I mean by saved the Jewish people? Saved them from whom? Okay. Jewish people lived within the domain of Islam for over 1,000 years. In fact, the majority of them lived within the domains of Islam. Some of them lived in Christian lands and they were being persecuted, they were being killed off, they were being exiled, they were being brutalized. There are so many examples I can cite in this regard. In fact, to give you one example, hijab. When the Muslims arrived in Spain, In the year 711 CE, a Jewish historian called Zion Zohar, who is an American Jewish historian, he writes in his book, A History of Sephardic and Mizrahi Jewry, on page 8 and 9, he writes that history of Sephardic and Mizrahi Jewry. Okay. Basically, this is a history of the Sephardic Jews. Okay. Sephardic Jews are basically Jews who lived in the Middle East, mainly, or in the Muslim lands. So, in this history, on page 8 and page 9, he states, when the Muslims arrived at Gibraltar in 711 CE, the Jewish people welcomed them as liberators. So, who were they being liberated from is the question. Now, if you go back to Christian history of Spain, you will see in the year 633 CE, almost 80 years before the Muslims arrived, there was a council, a Catholic ecumenical council held in the city of Toledo. This was called the Fourth Council of Toledo. In this council,
when was this?
633 CE. In this council, I mean, anyone can Google the Fourth Council, 633 CE, exactly a year after the Prophet of Islam passed away.
That's right, yeah.
Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Okay. In this council, it was decreed by the Catholic Church that all the children of the Jewish people are to be taken away by force, and they are to be converted to Catholicism and are to be raised as pious Catholics by Catholics. In other words, forced conversion of the Jewish people and the children. This is the kind of persecution, destruction, and brutality the Jewish people were facing in Spain before the Muslims arrived. Therefore, when the Muslims came in 711 CE, almost 80 years after this this particular Catholic council, the Jewish people welcomed the Muslims as liberators. And this is confirmed by Jewish scholars, Jewish historians today.
Zion Zohar.
Zion Zohar is one of them, as quoted. So this was the attitude of the Jewish people who were being liberated from Christian persecution by the Muslims. And this happened even in the land of Palestine. When the second caliph of Islam, Umar bin Khattab, radiallahu anh, when he took the land of Palestine from the Byzantines, from the Romans, one of the clauses in the treaty that was agreed upon between the Christians and the Muslims at the time was that the Muslims will not bring the Jewish people into the city of Jerusalem with them. The Christians did not want the Jewish people in the city of Jerusalem. The text of the treaty can be found in the history of Tabari.
Okay.
It is there.
Tariq
al-Tabari. Yeah, Tariq al-Tabari, the text of the treaty is there. And one of the clauses put by the Christians as a special request from the Muslims was that you will not allow the Jewish people to come and live in the city of Jerusalem. Later on, having consolidated their power, the Muslims welcomed the Jewish people into the city of Jerusalem to come and live side by side with the Muslims.
And Thomas Arnold Walker also mentions this in his preaching of Islam as well, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Karen Armstrong. Karen Armstrong, who has written a history of Jerusalem. In that history, she specifically writes that it was under the system of Islam whereby the three Abrahamic faiths coexisted for the first time in history. It was under the rule of Islam. It was the system of Islam that facilitated this peaceful coexistence. Now, was it hijab? The question is now, was it just toleration, tolerance, or was it prosperity for the Jewish people?
Before we get there, let's play devil's advocate. Someone's going to say, well, you're mentioning all the points where Jewish people were welcomed in. But if you look, for example, you talked about Spain, someone can just bring up the Muwahidun and say, look, the Muwahidun were a very intolerant bunch. And in fact, they expelled the Jewish people and dealt them a very heavy hand.
Absolutely. There are cases, there are incidents whereby some Jewish people, some communities were targeted by some kings and some dynasties. But these were exceptional cases.
I see.
This was not the norm of the Muslim civilization.
And you're not denying that. You accept that there have been some of those people, because someone will say, well, in the beginning you said it's always been good. But you're saying that there's exceptions to the rule, and you wouldn't discount those, because someone's watching that and say, but what about this and what about that?
Yeah, first of all, we're not claiming a utopia.
Yeah.
We're not claiming a utopia. We're not claiming perfection. We're not saying that it was always 100% absolutely amazing. No. what we are saying is that overwhelming pattern, let's say,
yes.
the overwhelming condition or the condition of the Jewish people was positive overwhelmingly, okay, to put it in the right way. Okay, the Jewish people, from the very advent of Islam in Arabia all the way up to the 1930s, coexisted with the Muslims peacefully. In fact, they felt protected. They felt that they are prosperous. They felt that they are safe.
This so what is other the examples point. Of prosperity can you bring to the table then?
There are so many, and yeah. I will quote some of the Jewish testimonies in this regard.
Sure.
Okay, if me and you sit here and talk today and speak on behalf of the Muslim civilization and praising it and paying lavish tributes to it, that's going to be seen as bias.
Of course.
Okay, this is basically prejudice speaking. These Muslim propagandists sitting there in front of the camera, they are just... I'm not going to do that hijab today.
No, but what you've done is, you've quoted an academic resource of a Jewish scholar.
Zandora. Absolutely.
So far, that's what you've done. Then you quoted Karen Armstrong, who's a non-Muslim English scholar of academic.
Exactly. And I have a lot more. I have a plethora of quotes and testimonies from primary sources, Jewish rabbis and Jewish travelers who were living in those times, in those places, in those cities, under those dynasties, what they had to say about the Muslim treatment towards the Jewish people. And then later on, secondary sources, modern scholarship, also confirms those testimonies. Only the Zionist project has a problem with this. Only the Zionists have an agenda to reject this entire history. Only they question the notion of the golden age of the House of Israel under Islam. Only they are the ones who question this, because it dismantles their propaganda. It dismantles their narrative. What is the narrative? The Jewish people are perpetually threatened by the rule of Islam. The Jewish people basically are in danger from the Muslims, or the Palestinians for that matter. Okay, we will show that throughout history, for over 1,000 years, the Jewish people not only lived peacefully with the Muslims or under the rule of Islam, but prospered. So it became very happy and successful.
You are at the 7th and 8th century. You mentioned 711, that's 8th century, and then you mentioned kind of like the time of Umar al-Khattab, which is about the 7th century. So, okay, you've mentioned what's happening, say, in the Middle East and all the way up to Spain in that period of time.
Yes.
What if someone says, okay, that was in the beginning, but then things started taking a different turn?
That's not the case, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to produce evidence from different places and different times.
Okay.
And this evidence is going to give us pretty much the same picture.
Okay.
That the condition of the Jewish people remained pretty good throughout the history of the Muslim civilization. Yes, there were incidents where some Jewish people, for a number of different reasons, were targeted due to their political activism or other things, okay?
Yeah.
And many of these things happened because of political reasons, okay? But if you look at Jewish people as a community, merchants, traders, scholars, okay, physicians, they flourished throughout the history of Islam with the Muslims. And we're going to see the evidence, inshallah, very quickly. First thing I want to very quickly bring to attention for everyone to see is, how did the Jewish people feel under the rule of Islam? Okay, so the Zionist propaganda is that Jewish people are threatened. Okay, they will never be safe under the rule of Islam or with the Muslims. We will show that's not the case. To the contrary, if the Jewish people ever flourished throughout the history of diaspora, you know what diaspora is? Diaspora is Jewish exile from the Holy Land. In the year 132 CE, Emperor Hadrian banished the Jewish people from the land of Palestine on pain of death. If any Jew was found in the land of Palestine by the Roman authorities after this decree, that Jew would be killed on the spot.
Yeah.
Okay. So this happened after a famous revolt called the Revolt of Bar Kokhba. This took place when Emperor Hadrian, the Roman emperor, one of the most powerful Roman emperors, was ruling from Rome, Hadrian. And the city of Jerusalem was completely razed to the ground and renamed Elia after the name of the Roman emperor, Elias Hadrianus. Okay. So Since then, the Jewish people were scattered all over the world. They were scattered. This is what the Jewish people referred to as the diaspora. Okay, the Jewish people suffered severely under the Roman rule, firstly, and then the Christian rule, because the Christians were also anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. Why? Because they blamed the Jewish people of doing what?
Killing their God.
Killing God.
Yeah.
Okay, what we call deicide.
Mm.
Okay, so the Jewish people were accused of killing Jesus Christ.
Mm.
So his crucifixion, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, was instigated according to the Gospels, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the Gospel text,
mm.
it has two people blamed for the crucifixion and the brutalization of Jesus Christ. The Jewish people, the rabbis, the Jewish authorities of the city of Jerusalem, and the Roman authorities. Okay, so the Jewish people suffered first under the Romans, then the Christians came to power after some Roman emperors accepted Christianity. They converted to Christianity. They started to persecute the Jewish people. It was not until Islam came to the scene that the Jewish people could find some respite,
mm.
some refuge, some level of peace and tolerance where they could flourish, where they could produce scholars, poets, merchants, traders, rabbis, okay, theologians, intellectuals, politicians, prime ministers,
mm-hmm.
prime ministers. To give you one example, in the 10th century, the most powerful king in Western Europe was a man called Abdurrahman III, who was the caliph in
Spain, mm-hmm.
who ruled much of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who his prime minister was?
Mm.
This was a very powerful man called Hasdai ibn Shaprut.
Mm.
Hasdai ibn Shaprut was the prime minister of the Muslim caliph in Cordoba,
mm-hmm.
because Cordoba was the center of the caliphate, the Umayyad caliphate in Spain.
Mm.
In 929, Abdurrahman III declared himself to be the caliph of the Muslim world, and his prime minister was none other than a Jewish man called Hasdai ibn Shaprut. Hasdai ibn Shaprut, when he was the vizier,
yes,
the prime minister, he wrote a letter to the Jewish king of Khazars, which was a territory near Georgia today. And he writes in this letter from Al-Andalus, "Praise be to the beneficent God for his mercy towards me, king of the earth, to whom his the caliph's magnificence and power are known. Bring gifts to him, conciliating his favor by costly presents, such as the king of the Germans and the king of the Jebelim, the king of Constantinople and others. All their gifts pass through my hands, and I am charged with making gifts in return. Let my lips express praise to the God in heaven who so far extends his loving kindness towards me without any merit of my own, but in the fullness of his mercies. I always ask the ambassadors of these monarchs about our brethren, the Jews, the remnant of the captivity, whether they have heard anything concerning the deliverance of those who have pined in bondage and had found no rest." Basically, Hasdai ibn Shaprut was...
Where can we find that? If someone says, what's the source of this thing?
We will put the source in the comment section. Okay. We will put all the sources, the entire text of these quotes, in the first comment, the pinned comment of this video. People can go and check out these sources.
Okay.
Because we're going to be putting out a lot of stuff here.
Okay.
So people can find the secondary and the primary sources I am quoting from.
Yeah.
Hasdai ibn Shaprut is the prime minister of Spain, Islamic Spain, writing a letter to his Jewish counterpart, the king of Khazars in Khazaria.
Where's asking, Khazaria?
Khazaria is current-day Georgia, close to Georgia. Okay. This territory became Jewish. It's a long story.
Really?
Okay. The Khazars, they are Jewish converts.
Well, the whole thing.
The whole territory. The king became Jewish, and his people also followed him into Jewish. This is the 9th century in particular when the people converted.
Really?
800s.
Okay, very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah.
So Hasdai had found out about them. So Hasdai is writing to the king of Khazars, asking him whether they are the lost Jewish tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Which lost Jewish tribes? In 721 BC,
yeah.
The Assyrians attacked the northern state of Israel. Because after Solomon, King Solomon, Suleiman alayhi salam.
And when we say Israel here, 721.
This Israel is basically the Israelites, 10 tribes ruling a territory they called Israel.
So this is Eretz Israel, right?
Yes, that's right. This is
because the word Israel didn't really, I mean, Eretz, the land of the Israels.
No, it was a state because after Solomon, King Solomon ruled a confederacy of 12 tribes of the Israelites.
Yeah.
After he died, this confederacy basically split into two states. In the south, we had Judea ruling from the capital of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And in the north, we had Israel consisting of 10 tribes.
Israel,
the state, they called it the state of Israel.
Okay.
It wasn't the current state of Israel, clearly, because they were religious people.
Mm.
They were Israelites. They had prophets among them. Okay.
Yeah.
So their capital was Samaria.
Mm.
Okay.
Which is modern day what?
Modern day, it's close to, it's in Palestine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's in Palestine. Okay. So 721, Assyrians are north. This basically dynasty or these people, Assyrians, were ruling territory in northern Iraq, parts of Turkey and parts of Syria. They were called Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A Mesopotamian civilization. They attacked the northern country of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They took these 10 tribes into exile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And these 10 tribes disappeared from history forever. So Hasda ibn Shaprut was actually inquiring about these 10 lost tribes of Israel.
Mm.
Okay. So Hasda ibn Shaprut was a very powerful man. Why am I quoting Hasdai and what he said about his own position, that he was the vizier and he was receiving all the gifts for the caliphs and he was returning these gifts to the kings on behalf of the caliph. So this is a very powerful position.
Mm.
Okay. Clearly someone marginalized, someone who is disliked or hated wouldn't be in this position. That's the point I'm making.
Mm.
Moving on. Okay. Another character who had a similar powerful position in Spain was Samuel ibn Nagrela. Samuel ibn Nagrela was a very powerful diplomat, politician, and the prime minister of the state of Granada,
mm-hmm.
okay, in southern Spain. And one of his biographers called Abraham ibn Daud, writing, you know, in the 12th century, a Jewish chronicler, he elaborates upon Hanagid's significance for the spread of the Jewish tradition. Samuel ibn Nagrela was also called Hanagid. Okay. So he writes, he achieved great good for Israel in Spain. The Maghreb, Africa, Egypt, Sicily, indeed as far as the Academy in Babylonia and the Holy City. The Academy of Babylonia was in Iraq, under the rule of Islam, by the way. Mm. The Muslims were ruling Iraq at the time. Okay. He provided material benefits out of his own pocket for students of Torah in all these countries, Muslim countries.
Yeah.
This is a Jewish prime minister in Islamic Spain, in the state of Granada, who is doing all this benefit for the Jewish people.
What are we talking about?
Samuel, we're talking about the 11th century.
Okay.
1060s,
okay.
To be precise.
Okay.
Samuel Hanagid. Samuel ibn Nagrela Hanagid. Okay. So he was benefiting not only his own people in Spain, Islamic Spain, where the Jewish people were living at the time. He's benefiting all the Jewish people living in Maghreb, current day Morocco, Africa, which is Tunisia, Egypt, Sicily, and even as far as Iraq and the Holy City, which is Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Okay. So Abraham ibn Daud goes on to say, he provided material benefits out of his own pocket for students of Torah in all these countries. He also purchased many books of the Holy Scriptures as well as of the Mishnah and Talmud, which are also among the holy writings. Throughout Spain and the countries just mentioned, whoever wished to devote full time to the study of the Torah found in him a patron. Moreover, he retained scribes who would make copies of the Mishnah and Talmud, which he would present to students who were unable to purchase copies themselves, both in the academies of Spain as well as of the other countries we mentioned. These gifts were coupled with annual contributions of olive oil for the synagogues of Jerusalem, which he would dispatch from his own home. He spread Torah abroad and died at a ripe old age after having earned 4 crowns, the crown of Torah, the crown of power, the crown of Levite, and the towering over them all by dint of good deeds in each of these domains, the crown of a good name. Samuel bin Nagrela Hanagit, the prime minister of Granada in Muslim Nasirid dynasty. Okay, helping all the Jewish people in Muslim territories who were living in peace and harmony in Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, Jerusalem, as far as Iraq. Because so powerful was this prime minister, he was helping students of the Torah, the Mishnah, and the Talmud, the Jewish tradition, in other words. He was trying to promote Jewish scholarship, Jewish theology, by patronizing all of these students and scholars in all the Muslim territories these Jewish scholars were living in. What does that tell you, Hijab? I want your commentary on this. What does that show you?
No,
what
do you think of it? Right now, this is very, very edifying, because a lot of people will be thinking, I mean, for a Jewish person to even reach this level of political authority, I mean, you can't argue a persecution narrative here, can you? I mean,
absolutely not.
And this is, as you're saying, it's kind of like going into, effectively, this is the golden age.
Yes.
Golden age of, and I think this would be classified as the golden age of Islam and also the golden age of Judaism as well. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. And guess what, Hijab?
Yeah.
Jewish scholars themselves have said this.
I mean, Maimonides, when did he come about?
Maimonides was born in the 12th century in Cordoba.
Yeah.
And then he had to leave Cordoba due to a very difficult situation there, because a new dynasty had come in, known as Al-Muwahidun or Al-Mawhids.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had persecuted not only the Jewish and the Christian people, Muslims, but the Muslims as well, right? So many people escaped. So Maimonides escaped to what? To where? To Muslim lands.
Yeah.
He left Cordoba for where? Egypt.
Egypt, yeah.
Ayyubid Egypt, and became...
Would he not be a surgeon or something like that?
He was a private physician to the Sultan himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Which Sultan? Sultan Salahuddin, the famous Saladin. Mm. Yes. So Maimonides, having left Spain, a Muslim territory, for another Muslim territory in Egypt, where he became the private physician, the private doctor of Sultan Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. So Maimonides stands as a towering figure in Jewish history. Mm. He's called the second Moses. Mm. He's also called the Rambam. Okay, mm-hmm. He's known as Rambam within the Jewish tradition. And the reason why
second
it's called
Moses,
the second Moses...
His actual name is Musa bin Maimun.
Yeah, exactly. His Arabic name is Musa bin Maimun. He even wrote his books in the Arabic language using Hebrew characters.
I read a book of his, actually.
A Guide to the Perplexed.
Dira'at al-Harin.
Yes. Yes, yeah. a guide for the perplexed.
Because he writes about kalam and stuff like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Very, very, and guess what? A lot of that stuff was taken from the Muslim philosophers of the time.
He took it from Ibn Rushd.
100%. 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was heavily inspired by Muslim philosophy of the time. Yeah. He wrote in the Arabic language. He was pretty much a Muslim philosopher.
Oh, yeah.
Without being a Muslim.
The arguments are very similar, to be honest.
But what was the situation of the Jewish people in Spain? I mean, one can argue that, oh, these were prime ministers. You mentioned Hazda ibn Shaprut. You mentioned Samuel bin Nagrela Hanagit. And these people were very powerful, no doubt. One was a vizier, a prime minister in Cordoba.
Yeah.
The other one was a vizier in Granada, okay? The capital city of the Nasrid dynasty of Granada. What about the common Jewish people living in Spain at the time?
Yeah.
Let's go to a rabbi.
Okay.
Let's go to a Jewish rabbi writing in 1080s,
okay,
in the city of Cordoba.
So
very
what
famous.
Dynasty was this? You know,
this was again the aftermath. This was Muluk al-Tawaif period.
Okay,
when Muslims had already pretty much split into many different small dynasties in Spain. This is after the Umayyad Caliphate had already fallen.
Okay.
Okay. So we talked about the vizier, the prime minister of the Umayyads, speaking from Cordoba in the 10th century. Let's go on to the next century, 1080s, in the 11th century, Bahya bin Bakuda, a Jewish rabbi, he writes from the city of Cordoba in the year 1080, to be precise. And I quote him in his Kitab al-Hidayah. He wrote a treatise, okay, titled Kitab al-Hidayah. In this book, this Jewish rabbi writes, "If one of our contemporaries looks for similar miracles now, let him examine objectively our situation among the Gentiles, Muslims in this case. Since the beginning of the diaspora and the way our affairs are managed, in spite of the differences between us and them, both secret and open, which are well known to them, let him see that our situation as far as living and subsistence are concerned is the same as theirs or even better. So Bahya bin Bakuda, writing in 1080 from the city of Cordoba, is saying that as far as the living conditions are concerned, we live better than the Muslims. Mm. Our living conditions are better than the Muslims. Mm. Now, this is absolutely amazing. This is fascinating. Mm-hmm. How the Jewish people, having been liberated from the Christian persecution of Christendom or Christian territories, felt so safe and happy within the Muslim territory. Now, one can argue that, oh, this may be, you know, due to the goodwill of the ruler,
yeah,
or the dynasty, mm, or maybe the culture of Spain. But we can move on to other territories.
Yeah, because someone will say, well, they're talking about, you know, Spain. Some historians refer to this period as a period of convivencia.
Exactly.
Coming together and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
maybe now, it was the culture.
It was the culture. I mean, that's, mm, and in fact, some scholars say that's the West you're talking about, actually. They've had the Western influence.
Not really, because the West was absolutely devastating for the Jewish people. Let me very quickly explain,
okay,
what was happening in the West at the time.
Yeah.
This is the same time when the Crusades are taking place. Mm. Pretty much about the same time.
Right.
The Crusades started in the 11th century, mm-hmm, soon after Bahya bin Bakuda was writing in, mm-hmm, Cordoba, because he was writing in 1080s, right?
Mm.
And Crusades started in 1090s, mm, 1095 to be precise, when Pope Urban II delivered his speech at Clermont and he instigated the Crusades,
yep,
right? In 1099, the Crusaders took the city of Jerusalem. Now, so much hate was found among Christians of the north, in Germany, France, and Britain, to be precise, because Eastern Europe was pretty much barbaric. They were still semi-civilized or semi-barbarized. Okay, you know, yeah, all these territories.
Some would really have a problem with this and say, look, that's...
No, but that's a historical fact.
They say that's, you know, that's a sweeping generalization.
No, it's not, because we don't know anything about Lithuania and Poland and all these territories at that time.
From silence, they'll say, you know.
But we would have any, if we had any texts, any literature, we would know about it, right?
Right, fine.
There's nothing. Yeah. It's like the Vikings. You know, the Vikings. Yeah. We don't have anything from the Vikings, unfortunately.
Right.
As beautiful as the artwork was, okay, we have found the tools, the weapons, some of the money they buried. We have found all of that. We have found the boats, okay, some of the helmets. They were capable of artwork. But we don't know anything about them. Likewise, Eastern Europe was pretty much in darkness in that sense, right? But Germans and the French and the British had already taken Catholicism as their religion, okay? They were heavily persecuting the Jewish people. Those Jewish people who existed with the Christians in the northern territories, in northern Europe, okay, they suffered severely. So when the Crusaders left their homes, mm, to go and liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims, every Jewish town they passed, they massacred. The Jewish community of Rhineland in Germany was completely decimated, was completely destroyed.
Yeah.
Okay? The Jewish people were completely wiped out in Germany. In fact, those bishops and churchmen who tried to save them, they were also burnt with the Jewish people by these angry mobs of the Crusaders.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, later on, Richard the Lionheart, when he announced his crusade against Sultan Salahuddin Ayyubi, how did he start his crusade? He started it with the Jewish people of London.
Mm.
A massacre against the Jewish people of London was conducted,
mm-hmm,
when Richard was the king. It doesn't stop there. Even afterwards, when Edward the Longshank, or Edward the First, the very famous king, you know, this movie, everyone's seen it, Mel Gibson's movie, Braveheart,
yeah.
Okay, the king depicted, and that movie is the king I'm talking about.
Wildly inaccurate movie, I've heard.
It is, of course, it's not historic.
Yeah.
Movies are not generally entirely historic, okay? Yeah. But there is a king depicted in the movie called Edward the Longshank.
Yeah.
Okay, this king also banished the Jewish people,
yeah,
from Britain, confiscated their properties, took their money because he needed money for his castle building program in North Wales. So, mm, he needed the money and he banished the Jewish people.
Mm.
Likewise, the King of France also banished the Jewish people in the 13th century, mm-hmm, similarly to what Edward did in England.
Mm.
So the Jewish people, the question is, where were they finding refuge? In Muslim lands, in Muslim territories, in large numbers. That's why many Jewish historians said this repeatedly, that the majority of the Jewish people lived under the domain of Islam for over 1,000 years.
So you mentioned Zion Zohar. Who else from like Jewish, what other Jewish historians have said that then?
We will see.
Okay, fine.
You'll be completely fascinated. So that's why I'm moving chronologically. I'm going with a chronology, okay?
Fine.
I'm mentioning these things from different places.
Yeah.
From different times, so that people don't think that we're just making things up.
Yeah, because what's happened, you started with 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
Okay, but before that, you went, really, you spoke about Umar al-Khattab a little bit, so that's in the 7th century, talking about the, like maybe around 640s, 650s, something like that.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you mentioned Tariq ibn Ziyad and his conquest in 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
You mentioned
and then the
Toledo,
consolidated. Yeah.
Before that, before 7-Eleven, you mentioned the Council of Toledo, which is in 636, you said?
633.
Mm-hmm. Whereby it was mentioned that the forced conversions.
Hmm.
So we have here already a kind of preamble of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
7-Eleven came along, and then you mentioned Zion Zohar. Zion Zohar stating in page 8 of his book, History of the Jews, or History of Jewry, that he mentioned that they considered the Muslims coming in as some kind of
liberators. Yes.
And then you mentioned, we kind of skipped a couple of centuries, but we went to the 11th century. And we talked about some of these wazirs, if you like, in the Cordoba and Granada.
Yeah. The point was that the Jewish people had reached such powerful positions that they couldn't possibly be marginalized.
Yes.
They couldn't be persecuted.
And what you've done just now is you've spoken about what the alternative really was in this Western Europe. So you spoke about Richard the Lionheart around, let's say, the 11th century, the end of the 11th century. And then you mentioned Edward Longshank.
Yeah.
As well.
So the Jewish people always lived in a state of fear in the Western world.
Yeah.
In Western Europe, in Northern Europe, okay? As late...
Could someone accuse you of being generalizing?
No, I am not, because the Jewish historians will confirm this.
Yeah.
And we will see.
Yeah.
When I read the quotes, you will be completely blown away. You'll be shocked to find that the Jewish people, the Jewish historians themselves stated that the Jews suffered severely under the rule of Christian kings and dynasties.
Yeah.
It was under the rule of Islam where they found refuge. The Muslims gave them refuge for over 1,000 years for them to survive and flourish.
Are we also going to cover the Ottomans as well?
Because
we've spoken somewhat about, you know, the Khalifa Rashidiyya, the Rashidun Caliphate. We've spoken a lot about the Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, there's going to be all that kind of discussion about bias because it's in Europe and European prerogative that they'll say, well, that's because it's on our continent kind of thing. And what about the Ottomans? I mean, someone will say, what about the Ottomans?
Yeah.
We haven't got to that yet, obviously.
We haven't got, because this is why I'm moving with rough chronology.
When was he around?
12th century.
Yeah,
12th century.
Yeah.
He died in 1204.
Okay. Yeah.
So he died in the early 13th century. He died in 1204, but he was alive in the 12th century.
Okay.
He was born in Cordoba and died in Egypt
under
the rule of the Ayyubids. Okay.
Yeah.
So another Jewish traveler called Benjamin of Tudela from Spain, a Spanish Jew who traveled to Baghdad in 1168 CE, again the 12th century.
Mm.
Describe the situation of the Iraqi Jews in these words.
Mm.
He states, in Baghdad, there are about 40,000 Jews, and they dwell in security, prosperity, and honor under the great caliph. And amongst them are great sages, the heads of the academies engaged in the study of the law.
Could one argue, and this is good, but could one argue that, well, this is, he had to say that because if he didn't say that and it was published, the authorities of the time would have killed him.
Well, he wasn't even publishing for these authorities. This he had written when he came back to Spain.
Ah,
so he was in security. He was writing for his own audience, for his own people.
Mm.
He's simply testifying to the peace and prosperity.
So the fact that he was a traveler strengthens the argument.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he came from Spain. He was a Spanish Jew who traveled to Spain. And I'm assuming
a little bit like Ibn Battuta,
kind of, or he probably could have traveled for two reasons: trading or seeking knowledge of the law from the sages he mentions in this quote.
Oh, I see.
In Baghdad or in Babylon. This the oldest Jewish community in the
Islamic
world.
What Islamic dynasty was this?
This was the Abbasids. The caliph at the time was Al-Mustanjid. The caliph at the time ruling was Al-Mustanjid, who ruled from 1160 to 1170 CE. Okay?
So was this when the Ayyubids had also established
themselves? Exactly. Ayyubids are not around yet. This is the Zengid period.
Right.
Imaduddin Zinki
and
his son Nuruddin Zinki.
Uh-huh.
So Sultan before. Sultan Salahuddin Ayyubi is still a very young man at this time. Okay. So when Benjamin Tudela, when he traveled, 1168 is the year, Sultan Salahuddin Ayyubi would be by this time 31 years old. Okay, uh-huh. Because he was born in 1137.
So the Ayyubid dynasty was established, what, 30 years after that?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Yes, yes. So this is not the Ayyubid period yet. So, but the Abbasid
were quite weak at the time, right?
Exactly. But the caliph did rule the territory of Baghdad or around Baghdad.
Yeah.
So the caliph had power in Baghdad. That's why he mentions the caliph, that the great caliph, and amongst them are great sages, the heads of the academies engaged in study of the law. So he's talking about the Jewish rabbis in Iraq, who were the most ancient community, the Jewish community in the world.
Really?
Since the Babylonian exile.
Mm.
That took place in the 6th century BC, to be precise, 587 BC, when the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar took...
Mentioned the Bible.
Yeah, the exile, the famous Babylonian exile into Babylon, into Iraq. Babylon was Iraq, okay? Whereby the entire Israelite population, whatever remained of the Israelites, because the 10 tribes are already gone. Remember, I mentioned the Assyrians came in 721 CE, 721 BC, before Christ. They took the entire population into exile and they disappeared from history. We have no idea what happened to those 10 tribes of the Israelites. What remained was two tribes, the Benjamites and the Levites. They were taken into exile by the Babylonians in 587 BC. And this was the first time when the Temple of Solomon, Masjid al-Aqsa, was razed to the ground. This was the first destruction of the temple. Okay, so since that time, the Jewish people, some of them, never left Iraq. Even throughout the Muslim period, the Jewish people remained in Iraq. And the best Jewish scholars, the best rabbis, were born in Iraq. The Babylonian Talmud was authored in Iraq, and it was finished during the Muslim period.
Really?
Yes, it was finished during the Muslim period. Okay. Just around the Muslim period, when the Muslims just came.
Do you know when it started?
It is very difficult to say when it was started.
Okay.
It was. There are two Talmuds.
The Palestinian.
The Palestinian and the Babylonian.
And it's so ironic that they say that Palestine was not an entity or not a word.
Yeah.
And yet they have a Talmud by its name.
The Palestinian Talmud, exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So the Babylonian Talmud was pretty much completed when the Muslims had already taken over Iraq.
Yeah.
Okay, from the Sassanid Empire. And these Jews remained in Iraq until the State of Israel was created.
No.
You see, the point I'm making is that the best Jewish scholars, the topmost Jewish academy in the world, Darul Ifta, where the fatwas are coming, the rabbis in Iraq were delivering fatwas for the entire Jewish community in the world.
Mm.
Even British Jews during the Middle Ages, when they had questions, they wrote letters to the academies of Babylon. They called it Babylon. It was Iraq during the Muslim period. So I'm pretty sure Benjamin Tudela came for similar reasons, to even learn for either learn from the scholars in Baghdad or in Iraq or for trading purpose. But the point here is security, prosperity, and honor. Three words he mentions very specifically. Benjamin Tudela states, in Baghdad, there are about 40,000 Jews, and they dwell in security, prosperity, and honor. This is a Jewish traveler from Spain testifying to the security, prosperity, and honor of the Jewish people living in Iraq with the Muslims. Now, moving forward, in 1420, a rabbi called Yitzhak Sefarti...
So what are we talking about here? What dynasty?
We're talking about now Ottomans.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, we're very close to the Ottoman periods.
I mean, the Ottomans were established here, wasn't
they? Yeah, yeah, pretty much in this territory.
In what, 1299 or something?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So he writes, okay, in 1420, Rabbi Yitzhak Sarfati wrote a letter to his persecuted German brothers from the Ottoman Turkish territory, Edirne. From Edirne, he's writing from Edirne. A Jewish rabbi living with the Muslims in Edirne writes to his German counterparts, inviting them to join him in prosperous and tolerant Islamic lands. And he writes, and I quote, "Your cries and laments have reached us. We have been told of all the sorrows and persecutions which you suffer in German lands. Listen, my brothers, if you knew even the tenth of what God has blessed us with in this land, you would give heed to no further difficulties. You would embark at once to us. Here the Jew is not compelled to wear a yellow hat as a badge of shame. You will be free of your enemies. Here you will find peace." Rabbi Yitzhak Sarfati. Okay? Sarfati. Yitzhak Sarfati, writing in 1420. Okay? From Edirne. From the Ottoman territory, when the Ottomans are ruling Edirne. Adrianople. Okay? And he writes to German Jews to invite them to that territory. Why are you suffering in Germany?
So okay. They were suffering in Germany from all the way back in the 15th century.
Absolutely. I already told you that during the Crusades.
But Germany in particular, like it was...
Yes, Germany was never friendly to the Jewish people.
Mm. Is there a reason for that? Or?
We don't know. There are many books written on this, by the way. There are chunky volumes written by Jewish historians about the persecution the Jewish people faced in Christendom in particular.
But okay. They will say that Jews were enslaved at this time in the garrisons and all that.
No. Jews, generally speaking, indulged in usury. Okay? Yes. Giving debts to people against heavy usury. And this is why many of the Jewish rabbis and the Jewish merchants were hated. Okay? You can see that in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, right?
Mm.
Okay, that depiction is there as late as the 16th century. Okay, and it continues.
Was it the case that Catholics were not doing usury like that? Because
there were Catholics doing it.
Yeah,
but many kings throughout the Middle Ages used Jewish people for this purpose.
Okay,
they were called King's Jews in many different places. The masses hated them because of this indulgence in usury. And whenever the masses found an opportunity to massacre the Jewish people, because they were not allowed to indulge in any other trade. The Jewish people were not allowed to indulge in any other trade. So they had found usury as a way out. Okay. And it made them, live with relative ease.
Because in Jewish law, it's not allowed to do usury with other Jews, but you can do usury with non-Jews.
Yeah, this is a separate topic. This is to do with the Talmudic position on...
Well, the Islamic position is that you can't do it full stop.
Absolutely. Islamically, we cannot do usury at all, full stop.
Give or receive it.
Exactly. Muslims or non-Muslims. Mm. Muslims or non-Muslims, give or take.
Yeah.
No usury.
Yeah.
No usury. But in the Jewish law, the situation is different, of course. And this is what Jewish rabbis can comment on.
Mm.
Okay? So we're dealing with history right now.
Mm.
So let's talk about another quote from another rabbi, an Italian rabbi, Obadiah Yare da Bertinoro, traveled to Jerusalem in 1486, when the Mamluks are ruling the city of Jerusalem, okay? Because the Ottomans only took it in 1516, okay? So to this time, in 1486, the Mamluks are ruling the city of Jerusalem, a Muslim dynasty. He wrote a letter to his father telling him about the country and his people. And he writes, "The Jews are not persecuted by the Arabs in these parts. I have traveled through the country in its length and breadth, and none of them has put an obstacle in my way. They are very kind to strangers, unlike what the Israelis are doing today. Particularly to anyone who does not know the language. And if they see many Jews together, they are not annoyed by it. In my opinion, an intelligent man versed in political science might easily raise himself to be a chief of the Jews as well as of the Arabs." So what this Italian rabbi, having been to Italy, having lived in Italy, the contrast he founds in Mamluk Jerusalem is that the Arabs are very kind to the Jewish people in these lands. They are not alarmed by Jewish assemblies. And if you become learned in political science, for example, if you become a politician, you can be very powerful. You can raise to higher ranks, even among the Arabs. Okay. In other words, there was no Arabian apartheid. There was no Muslim apartheid. The Muslims did not treat the Jewish people as riffraff, as dirty people to be thrown around, or as someone degraded, someone you look down upon. No, the Jewish people were very prosperous, very powerful, very happy, very, very rich in terms of economic capacity. This is what this rabbi is saying. We have a lot of evidence to go through, so let's move on very quickly, okay? So, I will also quote another Jewish rabbi, okay? Actually, this is about... This is another, a Jewish historian called Elijah Kepsali, who describes the Jewish prosperity in the Ottoman Empire in the following way. Okay? The Jews gathered together from all the cities of Turkey, both far and near, each person coming from his own place and community gathered in Constantinople in its thousands and its tens of thousands. The heavens helped them too, and the king provided them perfect estates and houses filled with all kinds of goodness. The Jews resided there with their families and their clans. They were fruitful and swarmed and multiplied, and the land was full of them. From that day on, whenever the king conquered a place where there were Jews, he would immediately shake them up and drive them from there and dispatch them to Constantinople, the seat of his kingdom, and he would pick them up and cuddle them forever. Now, since the Jews feared the Lord, he provided them with houses filled with all kinds of goodness in a place where formerly, at the time of the king of Byzantium, there were only two or three congregations. The Jews increased in numbers, becoming a people with more than communities, for the land could not support them altogether, for their prosperity was overwhelming. This is during the Ottoman period in Constantinople.
And his name is Elijah?
Elijah Kepsali.
Prosperity this is overwhelming.
Yeah, their prosperity is overwhelming. This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
The Zionists have an audacity to claim that they, i.e. the Jewish people, are threatened by Islam, Muslims, or Palestinians for that matter. The Jewish people lived in these territories for more than 1,000 years without any persecution, without any torture. The Zionist project disrupted the entire peace. The Zionists came in, having given this land by the British. The land didn't belong to the British. They gave the land to the Zionist project, and the Zionists committed the atrocities that are unspeakable. A human being cannot imagine the kind of things they did. Mass murder of the Palestinians. 1 million people driven out of their homes. Okay, when did the Muslims do this to the Jewish people is the question. When did the Muslims ever do this to the Jewish people? To the contrary, Muslims protected the Islamic civilization throughout its history. Whether the dynasties, the Ottomans, the Ayyubids, or the Umayyads in Spain, the Jewish people felt secure and prosperous under the rule of Islam. This is the point here that needs to be noted. So we will move on very quickly, and we will see that it doesn't stop there. Another Jewish migrant, the Portuguese Jewish chronicler Samuel Usk, okay? Because the Jewish chroniclers themselves testify to the Muslim kindness towards their people. Okay, this is again, I will check when he was writing. I'll get back to you, but people can check. Samuel Usk, okay? He was a Portuguese Jewish chronicler, Portuguese. His name was Samuel Usk. He shed some light upon the Jewish migrants' condition in the city of Salonika, which was under the Ottoman rule. Salonika is currently in Greece, but it was ruled by the Ottomans. And so long as the Ottomans ruled, the Jewish people had one of the most flourishing communities in this city, in the city of Salonika, also known as Thessaloniki. Okay, It's in northern Greece. He writes, Samuel Usk writes, the majority of my children who have been persecuted and exiled from Europe and many other parts of the world have taken refuge in this city. And she embraces them and receives them with as much love and goodwill as if she were Jerusalem, that old and ever pious mother of ours. Okay. Mm. That old and pious mother of ours, Jerusalem, under the rule of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's been under the rule of Islam for nearly 1,000 years already when Samuel Usk is writing. Okay. And he is equating Salonika with Jerusalem when it comes to prosperity and security for the Jewish people. Salonika was at this time ruled by the Ottomans when Samuel Usk was writing. Okay. Another Italian Jewish traveler, David De Rossi, okay, an Italian Jewish traveler called David De Rossi writes, he traveled through the Ottoman Empire during the 16th century. He documented his observations about Jewish people living in Safed as follows. Safed is basically the Muslim territory, you can say. The exile here is not like our homeland. The exile here is not like our homeland.
Mm.
The Turks hold respectable Jews in esteem. Here and in Alexandria, Egypt, Jews are the chief officers and administrators of the customs and the king's revenues. No injuries are perpetuated against them in all the empire. Only this year, in consequence of the extraordinary expenditure caused by the war against Shah Tahmasp, a Sufi, were the Jews required to make advances of loans to the princes. So he's saying the Jews were so advanced and so rich that...
Was he a chronicler, you said?
No, he was an Italian traveler.
Okay.
Okay. Writing in the... David De Rossi, writing in the 16th century... How we know this was the 16th century? Because there's a reference to Shah Tahmasp. Tahmasp was the king of Persia at the time in the 16th century.
The
Ottomans were in a war with the Persians. And only at this time, the Jewish rabbis, or sorry, not Jewish rabbis, Jewish traders, were asked to give loans to princes, Ottoman princes, to fight the war.
Okay? What Persian empire was it?
Safavids. Yeah. Okay. Now we move on to some contemporary
views.
Okay. Yeah. Recent scholarship, very quickly. Okay. Karen Armstrong notes in her History of Jerusalem that the Jews hailed the early Islamic conquerors of the Byzantine lands as a mercy from God. Karen Armstrong writes, toward the end of the 7th century, a Hebrew poem hailed the Arabs as the precursors of the Messiah and looked forward to the ingathering of the Jewish exiles and the restoration of the temple. Even when the Messiah failed to arrive, Jews continued to look favorably on Islamic rule in Jerusalem. In a letter written in the 11th century, the Jerusalem rabbis recalled the mercy God had shown his people when he allowed the kingdom of Ishmael to conquer Palestine.
What's she talking about? What year?
11th century, a Jewish rabbi wrote this letter.
Yeah.
Okay, she's quoting a letter. They were glad to remember that when the Muslims arrived in Jerusalem, there were people from the children of Israel with them. They showed them the spot of the temple and they settled with them until this very day. So she's referring to when Omar came in, the spot of the temple was buried under rubble. So since the Jews came with the Muslims, in other words, remember, the Jewish people were not allowed to live in Jerusalem from the Roman period.
Why is she saying 11th century then? Because
this is a Jewish rabbi. She's quoting a Jewish rabbi.
Oh, he's speaking about...
Yeah, he's speaking...
From the 11th century.
Exactly.
About the 7th.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In about 750, the Jewish author of The Mysteries of Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai saw the building of the Dome of the Rock as a prelude to the Messianic age. He praises the Muslim caliph as a lover of Israel who had restored the breaches of Zion and the breaches of the temple.
What was the name of the... Does she mention the name of the...
The rabbi? No, she doesn't mention. Okay. She simply writes that they were glad to remember that when the Muslims arrived in Jerusalem, there were people from the children of Israel. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So she says the Jerusalem rabbis recalled the mercy.
Okay.
She doesn't mention. So this is taken from the History of Jerusalem. Karen Armstrong's History of Jerusalem. The references will be in the comment section, inshallah.
Yeah.
And this is what I referred to earlier. This is exactly what the quote is. These are her exact words, Karen Armstrong.
Yeah.
The Muslims had established a system that enabled Jews, Christians, and Muslims to live in Jerusalem together for the first time.
Mm.
These are the words of Karen Armstrong, paying a tribute to the Muslim system. Professor Dean Philip Bell, who is Dean and Professor of Jewish History at Spertus Institute of Jewish Studies in Chicago, writes the following. Jews under medieval Islam never suffered from the same general negative perception as in the Christian West. Despite regional variations and high medieval political instability, in medieval Islam, multicultural environments combined with active engagement in sciences and literature led to something of an Islamic golden age for the Jews, at least according to most historical accounts. It has been primarily in the context of recent political developments that the once assumed positive views of Jewish life under medieval Islam have been seriously questioned.
So anachronism has been put in play.
Absolutely. Yeah. What Professor Dean Philip Bell is saying here is that this perception, or the perception that the Jews lived in prosperity and security throughout the Muslim territory during the Muslim period, or what they call the golden age of the Jewish people under Islam, this notion has only been questioned by recent political developments. What is he talking about?
Yeah.
He's talking about the State of Israel.
Yes.
It was only after the creation of the State of Israel, when the Zionist project took this land and drove out the Palestinians, now to claim superiority over this land and over the civilization of the Palestinians, they had to make the Muslim civilization look bad.
The narrative had to be
the
changed.
Exactly. If the narrative goes as follows, that the Jews lived in prosperity and in security, the Muslim civilization protected the Jewish people for over 1,000 years, why then do you need a Zionist state of Israel? Why can you not live with the Muslims side by side?
Clear motivation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they tried changing the narrative. They tried changing the image. They tried changing the perception that the Jewish people ever live with Islam in prosperity and security. This is what Dean Philip Bell is talking about.
Yes.
The recent political developments have challenged once assumed positive views of Jewish life under medieval Islam.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. This is very important, by the way. And this, I mean, what we are saying today here has been noticed or noted by major academics in the field. Dean Philip Bell is the is a dean and professor of Jewish history at Spertus Institute of Jewish Studies in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Another quote I want to very quickly share with you. I have mentioned him already. Zion Zohar, who is also a contemporary American Jewish historian, he confirms the Jewish appreciation of the Muslim arrival in Spain. Zion Zohar writes, amazingly, "Thus, when the Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar from North Africa in 711 CE and invaded the Iberian Peninsula, Jews welcomed them as liberators from Christian persecution."
Yeah.
Then he goes on to write,
"Born
during this era of Islamic rule, the famous golden age of Spanish Jewry, circa 900 to 1200, produced such luminaries as statesman and diplomat Hasdai ibn Shaprut, wazir and army commander Shmuel Hanagid,
The ones that you mentioned.
The one we mentioned. Poet philosophers Solomon bin Gabriel and Judah Halevi, and at the apex of them all, Moses bin Maimun, also known among the Spaniards as Maimonides." So Zion Zohar is pretty much confirming the golden age of the house of Israel under the rule of Islam.
Yes.
Basically. So he's not only saying that the Jews welcomed the Muslims as liberators in 711 CE when they came to Spain, but the Muslims actually gave them a golden age in return. And the Jewish people, so long as the Muslims ruled Spain, lived with the Muslims. They chose to live with the Muslims. After the last stronghold of the Muslims fell to the Catholics in 1492, what happened to the Jewish people? All of them were completely decimated.
Yeah.
The Jewish people were in smaller number. So the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, okay, gave the Jewish people two choices. You convert or you die. You convert or you die.
Mm.
Many Jewish people were killed because...
You're talking about the Inquisition.
This is before the Inquisition.
Yeah.
As soon as they took the city of Granada,
mm.
and of course, many of the Jewish people had to face Inquisition because some of them pretended to convert,
mm.
just like the Muslims did.
Mm.
So the Jewish people became the conversos, okay, and the Muslims became the Moriscos.
So we're talking about 1492 then, right?
1492 onwards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the most difficult and brutal period in the lives of Spanish Jews as well as Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Then we move on to the...
After that, is it correct to say that, okay, well, they then moved to the Ottoman Empire?
Yeah, many did. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Many did.
This is a very good point.
Yeah.
Timely mention of the Jewish removal to the Ottoman territories. Those Jews, very few of them, who could escape, where did they escape to? To Ottoman territories. They came to places like Salonika. They came to places like Constantinople.
Mm.
They came to places like Jerusalem. Now, the question is, those Jewish people who were living in Jerusalem during the Ottoman period, what happened to them?
Mm.
The Ottomans took the territory of Syria, Palestine, and Hejaz
mm.
from the Mamluks in 1516. Sultan Salim conquered these territories.
Mm.
And having conquered these territories, he claimed to be the first Ottoman caliph.
Mm-hmm.
What happened after that? We have a Jewish historian who studied in two volumes
mm.
the Jewish life as reflected in Muslim court documents from the Sigil of Jerusalem.
Mm.
Okay, the 16th century.
Is this the Ottoman Sigil?
This is the Ottoman Sigil.
Just to explain what the Sigil is then to the people, because recently I used the Sigil myself a few times. It's this one that's written in Ottoman Turkish, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so they've actually digitized this Sigil.
Yes.
And it's now part of, you can go online and there's a whole website that the Turkish government, and I think, responsible.
Absolutely
for.
Amazing.
Yeah,
amazing. And even this Jewish historian from Israel,
yeah.
his name is Amnon Cohen,
mm.
who has studied these particular records. He has published the facsimiles in these two volumes. So you can see the facsimiles there as well, right? So what is this? This is basically a study of a Jewish study of the Muslim court records from the city of Jerusalem
which
in the 16th
which
century.
To Jewish people?
Yeah.
Aha.
Just relating to the Jewish people.
Aha. Okay, so, 16th century, yeah?
Okay, let me very quickly explain.
Right.
This is a study of the Muslim court records
yes.
from the city of Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the records he studies are for 70 years.
Yeah.
From 1500 to 1570.
1500?
Okay. 1500? To 1570. This is the record he studies. So he studies the record of the Muslim court record.
Who's in charge? Bayezid and all that?
Sorry?
Who's the...
The historian.
The caliphs at the time.
This is basically the early Mamluk period and then during the reign of Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent.
Okay.
Sultan Suleiman came to power in 1520
mm-hmm.
and he ruled until 1566. So pretty much
you've done that from memory, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Mashallah.
Yeah. yeah.
This is why, you know. Anyway, go ahead.
So this is pretty much the entire reign of Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent.
Yes.
One of the most powerful Ottoman sultans.
And he's the one who's...
who besieged Vienna.
And also you got the beautiful mosque.
Yeah, Suleimania, and he's the one who besieged Vienna. This is how powerful he was.
Yeah, yeah.
In 1533, he besieged the city of Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
It pretty much nearly took Europe. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
The siege of Vienna.
Yeah, the famous siege of Vienna. Okay.
Mm.
That sent shivers down the European...
Spine.
Intellectuals, European spines. Yeah, even Martin Luther wrote about it.
The okay. Protestant,
yeah, Protestants. Yeah,
because exactly. He was around the same time, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's next door.
1517, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's
exactly.
When he wrote his Protestant Reformation.
Yeah. He was a contemporary,
mm.
and he's next door.
Yeah,
he's in Germany.
Oh, right,
right,
right.
Yeah. And this was the siege of Austria. Okay, Vienna.
Oh, right. And he wrote about that.
Yeah, he mentions it. So now, Amnon Cohen, who is a contemporary Israeli Jewish scholar,
yes.
he studied the Muslim court record for these 17
Very
years.
Interesting.
And his interest was simply in the Jewish cases.
Really?
Yeah, he was specifically studying the Jewish cases.
Yes.
He was checking if the Jewish people were applying
uh-huh.
For justice.
And just
to at the Muslim court.
One more point about the sigil, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the Arabic word is probably the same as the Turkish one here. Sigil literally means the record, effectively, the sigil. And one more thing about it, the Ottoman Empire probably has, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it probably has the most preserved court records, probably in all of Islamic
history. Absolutely, absolutely. This is why he was able to study it, okay? And the book is titled A World Within. A World Within, Jewish Life as Reflected in Muslim Court Documents from the Sigil of Jerusalem, 16th century. So, you know, what did he find? What did he find?
What did he find?
Let's study his findings. He writes, cases concerning Jews cover a very wide spectrum of topics.
Okay.
If we bear in mind that the Jews of Jerusalem had their own separate courts, the number of cases brought to Muslim court, which actually meant putting themselves at the mercy of a judge outside the pale.
So they had their own separate courts there?
Yeah, they had their own separate courts called Beth Dins.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbinical courts were available.
Can I make a point about that? Just that level of autonomy, and if you want to call it that, and it's a loaded term, but pluralism, right? That was afforded
legal,
yeah,
pluralism. I mean,
for Jewish people,
yes, it's
unlike even what we're granted here in the West.
100%. There is no precedent. There is no example of it.
Yeah.
There is no example of it today, even in the most secular liberal
states. The Islamic
states.
Sharia courts are not effective; they're ineffectual.
100%.
They don't have legal power.
Secular states, as liberal as they may be, like Sweden, Norway, Denmark, even they don't allow judicial autonomies to minorities.
Yeah.
The Islamic system allowed judicial autonomies to the Christians as well as the Jews.
And that's because of the prophetic commands, and that's because of the actions of the Khalifa.
Absolutely. Why would Muslims force their religion and law upon the Jewish people?
Mm.
They have their own law. Let them rule by their own law.
Mm-hmm.
So there were Beth Dins in Jerusalem.
What are they called?
Beth Dins. Mm. Beth Dins. B-E-T-H.
Mm-hmm.
Dins. D-I-N-S. Okay.
Okay.
So we continue with Amnon Cohen's quote. So he's saying that the Jewish people were applying to the Muslim court, which actually meant putting themselves at the mercy of a judge outside the pale of their communal and religious identity. It's quite impressive. The Jews went to Muslim court for a variety of reasons, but the overwhelming fact was their ongoing and almost permanent presence there. Okay. This indicates that they went there not only in search of justice, but did so hoping, or rather knowing, that more often than not, they would attain redress when wronged. The Jews went to court to resolve much more than their conflicts with Muslims or Christian neighbors. They turned to Sharia authorities. This is Amnon Cohen, by the way, a Jewish historian from Israel writing this, okay? They turned to Sharia authorities to seek redress with respect to internal differences, and even in matters with their immediate family, intimate relations between husband and wife, nafaka, maintenance, payments to divorcees, support of infants, etc., etc. This is the Jewish people in the 16th century coming to the Muslim judges, qadis, despite the fact that they have their own courts in the city of Jerusalem, where the rabbis are ruling over those courts. He goes on to say, their possessions were protected about the Jewish people now. He's writing a conclusion. Having discussed the law, how it dealt with the Jewish cases, the Muslim law, and the fact that the Jewish people are found to be permanently present in the Muslim court, applying for justice. And over 1,000 cases were filed within these 70 years.
Mm.
Over 1,000 cases were filed within these 70 years. He goes on, Amnon Cohen goes on to say, their possessions were protected, although they might have had to pay for extra protection at night for their houses and commercial properties. Their title deeds and other official documents indicating their rights were honored when presented to the court, being treated like those of their Muslim neighbors. The picture emerging from the sigil documents is baffling. On the one hand, we encounter recurring sultanic decrees sent to Jerusalem in response to pleas of the Jews to the effect that nothing should be done to stop them from applying their own law regarding a variety of matters. There are also many explicit references to the overriding importance of applying Sharia law to them only if they so choose. On the other hand, if we look closely at some of the inheritance lists, we see that the local court allocated to female members of Jewish families half the share given to male members, exactly as in Islamic law. This meant ipso facto a significant improvement in the status of Jewish women with respect to legacies over that accorded them by Jewish tradition. Although it actually meant the application of Islamic law in an internal Jewish context. He, the Muslim judge, defended Jewish causes jeopardized by high-handed behavior of local governors. He enabled Jewish business people and craftsmen to lease properties from Muslim endowments on an equal footing with Muslim bidders. More generally, he respected their rituals and places of worship and guarded them against encroachment, even when the perpetrators were other Muslim dignitaries. So the conclusion is from Amnon Cohen, having presented all this evidence and these findings after he studied the sigil record of the city of Jerusalem in the 16th century, the Ottoman sigil record, his conclusion is, no one interfered with their internal organization or their external cultural and economic activities. Talking about the Jewish people. In a world where civil and political equality or positive social change affecting the group or even the individual were not the norms, the Sultan's Jewish subjects had no reason to mourn their status or begrudge their conditions of life. The Jews of Ottoman Jerusalem enjoyed religious and administrative autonomy within an Islamic state. And as a constructive dynamic element of the local economy and society, they could and actually did contribute to its functioning. Therefore, the Jewish people of the city of Jerusalem during the Ottoman period were very powerful, very prosperous, very free to apply their own law to themselves or, if they so chose, the Sharia law in their affairs. All of this evidence, Brother Muhammad Hijab, presented to our audiences and the Jewish audiences and the Christian audiences out there. What does it prove? It proves that throughout the Muslim period, throughout the history of the Muslim civilization, for over 1,000 years, the Jewish people prospered, lived in harmony, and flourished, and were honored according to the testimonies of the Jewish historians, travelers, rabbis themselves. Today, the evidence I presented by the Muhammad Hijab in this presentation or in this podcast, none of the evidence I presented is for Muslims. Not one piece of evidence came from the Muslims. All the testimonies, all the studies, all the academic opinions we presented here today in this podcast are from the Jewish authorities.
And for someone then to make a claim of conspiracy would be absurd, wouldn't it? So you've got all these different accounts from different historical periods, different geographies, different places in Spain, in Greece, in Iraq, in the Ottoman Empire. They can't all be saying the same thing and lying or conspiring with
one another. It would be a global conspiracy going on for 1,000 years.
Yes.
Because these testimonies, you know, they are from, as you said, different places, different times, different people, facing different circumstances, different situations, different dynasties. But there is one thing common in all of these testimonies. Prosperity of the Jewish people, their honor, their protection, their security.
That's correct. Okay. You've read that out.
Exactly. So no one can, in his right mind, deny this evidence. It's like denying the sun. So when the Zionists come out today, just like they have been denying that they are committing a genocide against Palestinian children, nothing they say can be taken seriously. They are a bunch of liars.
Absolutely.
When they say that the Jewish people are threatened by Muslims or by Palestinians, they are a bunch of liars. Muslims are never anti-Jewish. If Muslim civilization or the Muslim dynasties or the Muslim armies wanted the Jewish people dead, there would be no Jew alive today in the world.
Absolutely.
There would be no Jewish community alive in the world because they were being persecuted and killed in Western Europe, in Northern Europe, and they found refuge with the Muslims. And Muslims took them in as cousins, as their own, and gave them reasons to be happy, reasons to flourish. So this propaganda, after this podcast, can be put to rest forever. Any Zionist who opens his mouth ever again,
yes,
about Muslims being anti-Jewish, Muslims being anti-Semitic, Muslims after Jewish blood, Muslims wanting a massacre or a genocide of the Jewish people, just send this link to them. Just send the video to them. Absolutely.
I think you've completely annihilated the claims.
And
I
hope so.
I think in order for someone to actually make a case against you, they would be having to... it's not just hermeneutical gymnastics. They're going to have to be ahistorical.
Absolutely. They will have to speak... Look, if I had quoted the primary sources and put my own spin on them,
yeah,
it would be a different matter. I quoted the primary sources
and the secondary
sources, yeah, of modern scholars,
yes,
Jewish modern scholars.
Yeah. None of them are Muslim.
None of them are Muslims. They're Jewish and they're saying the same thing I'm saying.
Yes.
What are they saying? The Jewish people flourished throughout the Muslim history. They witnessed, they experienced the golden age, whereby they produced some of the best intellectuals in the history, their best rabbis, their best poets, their best scientists, their best intellectuals, their best physicians, their best everything, their best viziers and generals were born throughout the Muslim period in Muslim territories.
Beautiful.
I think
that's fantastic. I think this is really good information. People from the non-Muslim community outside of Islam, now they can really look at Islam properly and look at the history of Islam properly.
Absolutely.
And with that, we will conclude. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for honestly giving me this opportunity.
And we'll put the all the references that he mentioned in the comment section, in pinned comment, and also in the description box. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
MashaAllah, you're still here. Just make sure that you donate by clicking the link below, because the rewards are unimaginable.